The book of Genesis, from chapter 33, verse 16, to the end of chapter 34. And here there are certain considerations to be weighed with regard to Jacob's movements following Peniel and his meeting with his brother Esau. Some think Jacob took a backward step to Succoth. For if you were to look at the map, you'd see it is slightly north of the brook Jabbok, although nearer Jordan and the land proper. Jacob seems to have regarded Succoth as a safe place, but afterwards he moved on across the Jordan to Shechem. And some people think the name Shechem has something to do with Shalom, which means peace, of course, Jerusalem and Solomon and all that. But we're not sure about that. He moved across the Jordan to Shechem, where he bought a piece of land and pitched an altar to God. But as we read that, remembering what happened to Jacob at Bethel more than 20 years before, we say to Jacob, Jacob, what about Bethel? You vowed that if God kept you until you returned to your father's house, which presumably meant your father's land, you would make that pillar that you set up and called Bethel, you would make it God's house, which is what the name Bethel means, house of God. Why then, Jacob, did you settle at Shechem? And how long did you live at Succoth before you came to Shechem? And why? There seems to be, Jacob, something not quite right here. And whether we can put our finger on the spot, and the one spot or the other, Succoth or Shechem, things begin, and we must admit this, Jacob, things begin to go wrong with you and your family. Which is more than daunting after the blessing of Peniel and your reconciliation with your brother. Ah, but then we say to ourselves, this is true to life, isn't it? Whether it is that we become complacent after blessing, or whether it is that Satan, being mad at us for being blessed by God, is ready to step in, and we are not aware enough of him. Probably both reasons, that we become complacent, and of course let the enemy creep into our lives, so that there's almost always a down after an up. Jacob should surely have returned to Bethel, which in view of his vow was a more important consideration even than his safety, which God could take care of anyway. So I ask you and myself, is there a parable for us here? Is there a lesson this morning in this chapter? I think there is. Shechem, of course, was one of the most important crossroads in the land. It's exciting for Jacob to return to Shechem, for Shechem was the first place that Abraham arrived at when he entered the land. You read that in Genesis 12:6. And this place is called Nablus today, one of the chief centers of Arab-Jew conflict in the West Bank. It's the place of Joseph's tomb, his bones being carried from Egypt and placed there, near to the well upon which Jesus sat so very much later on, when the woman of Samaria came to draw water. An exciting place and a crossroads in Israel. It's also the place between the two mountains, Ebal and Gerizim, where Joshua renewed the covenant, the Lord's covenant, when they entered the land of Canaan, and where the Samaritans still have a shrine on the top of Mount Gerizim. So Jacob arrived at Shechem, a wealthy man. And his purchase of the land from Hamor showed that he was more than up to the ways of business in Canaan. But as often, trouble came from perhaps the least to be expected quarter and source, his little daughter, who couldn't have been very old then, but would certainly have been a girl of marriageable age at this time. Dinah was born to Leah after Leah had borne Jacob 6 sons, half of the 12 who became the 12 tribes of Israel. Note that. Now, there's no word of any other daughter being begotten by Jacob, so that we could understand that this one girl among 12 boys was something of a rarity to the brothers, and how they would have cherished her, because she was a girl, as well as being one of the youngest of the family. Now, there was nothing wicked about her seeking to go out to meet the women of the land, although it was dangerous for her, wasn't it? And proved, of course, to be nothing less than disastrous. John Calvin certainly thinks she ought not have been allowed so much freedom in a land so much more primitive than the land she came from. And the sight of her proved too much for Hamor's son, Shechem. And without the laws, he and his father and his people did not have the laws of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They did not have knowledge of the Lord. And that is, I believe, knowledge of the Lord as far as the patriarchs are concerned, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Knowledge of the Lord, I believe, is some preconception of the Ten Commandments. But Shechem knew nothing of this, and so, being a very natural man, he claimed this girl for his own, and without more ado ended her virginity. Now, the original text doesn't use such an ugly word as rape. There are some horrid words in the New International Version translation that I do not like, and this is one of them. At any rate, it's not true to the Hebrew. But it simply says that he took her and lay with her. And the next verse clearly implies, of course, that he intended nothing less than marriage with her. His intentions were honorable enough, but without the scruple that this was a matter for the young girl's parents, not to say her adoring brothers, as well as a matter for her herself. And that in any case, in any civilized society, a marriage contract should be prior to intercourse. Like so many today, because of the unprincipled nature of people's lust, they put the cart before the horse. And of course, sooner or later suffer the consequences. Or do you not think there are unfortunate consequences for this sin as for other sins? Surely there are. However long they take to come to fruition. But the young man knew no better and was perfectly open with his father that he must get this girl for his wife. Now, when Jacob heard what the young pagan fellow had done, he kept quiet, whatever he thought. And of course, keeping your temper when things make you angry is perhaps a more significant sign of what you think than losing your temper. Wouldn't you say so? You see, it may take white heat a long time to explode. But beware when it does. One of the interesting things about this story, you see, is that Jacob, and I wonder if you've noticed this in reading the chapter, Jacob doesn't say a word until toward the end of the chapter he fumes at his own sons. Did you notice that? Now, it's not that he's not party to the subsequent negotiations as to circumcision and marriage, but that his voice was not heard. Isn't that strange? It was Jacob's sons who took over. Why was that? We don't know. But certainly Jacob was to pay for letting his sons give way to their rashness, their anger, you see, created a great deal of trouble for Jacob. Although their anger was more than legitimate. But you see, these men practically taking over from their father did wrong. Did they not think that Jacob also was deeply grieved about his dear only daughter? Why then did they not consult him as to what should be done? And so I ask the question, could it be that Peniel and Jacob's reconciliation with his brother, not to say Jacob's limp, you remember, had not only taken all the bounce out of the man, but the initiative also? And it may be that Jacob had some, well, I think it would have been so, that he had some understanding of this young man's attraction for his only daughter, and although deeply grieved that she had been humbled and defiled, he may very well have understood what had possessed this ignorant and ardent young fellow to seek her. So that Jacob may have been prepared, like many parents today faced with such a painful situation, may have been prepared to make the best and not the worst of the situation. How far Jacob would have conceded Hamor's plan to intermarry with the primitive people of Shechem and fit into the ways of that Canaanite land, we don't know. But we think he must have had, Jacob must have had more than misgivings about what Hamor suggested. Perhaps because Jacob, being the soul of shrewdness himself, as we know, suspected Hamor's motive, as indeed Hamor himself admitted to his own people in verse 23, that he intended to take over Jacob and his wealth. However, Jacob seems to have kept his own counsel and allowed his sons to strike a bargain with Hamor, and the Shechemites on their part were prepared, apparently, to go to all lengths, not only to get this girl for their most honorable son Shechem, but in the fullness of time to take over Jacob's wealth. And of course, at the heart of the agreement between the parties was this rite of circumcision which God had given to Father Abraham. And we have no doubt that that was at the heart of their belief in Abraham's and Isaac's and Jacob's God, these sons of Jacob.
Oh, yes, this was at the heart of the religion. Which, of course, with baptism, as Paul tells us in his Colossian letter, both symbolize the death and resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ. So they were giving honor to something that was far deeper than they knew, these boys. So they were to require that not only Shechem, but all the males of the Shechemite community should be circumcised before there could be any contract between them to give their precious girl to Shechem in marriage. Now, whether Hamor's dark hint that the ultimate intention was to take Jacob's wealth from him, whether that was a ruse on Hamor's part to induce all their males to undergo circumcision, or whether he really meant it, we don't know. But apparently, all the men consented. And the two sons of Jacob, for all their fury, waited patiently until these grown men were at the height of their physical pain from their circumcision. None of the prophylactics of modern surgery there. So they waited 3 days, and then they pounced and slew all their males from Hamor and Shechem, doubtless to the youngest boys, plundered their homes to recover their sister Dinah, and took their women and children and left the city desolate. What they did with these women and children may later appear, but it was surely an incredibly high-handed thing for even two fool brothers, the second and third of six, Simeon and Levi, to do. And, of course, ultimately, the other 10 brothers joined in seeking the plunder. And then Jacob's wrath blazed out at his sons because of the danger they were then in at the hands of the other Hevites or other Canaanites in the land, when they would hear what these incomers had done to some of the principal people of that area of their land. But all that the brothers would say in extenuation of the dreadful deed they perpetrated was that these Shechemites should not have treated their sister as a woman of shame. Then God took a hand, quietly and gently, but definitely, and got Jacob apparently out of that situation by moving him on to where he ought to have made for at the first, immediately after Peniel and his reconciliation with Esau. He moved him on to Bethel. And this is, therefore, you see, a story very full of meaning with many moral and spiritual implications. But, of course, the great danger in such a story is that we may isolate certain moral elements from it and concentrate on these without tracing the genesis of the story back to it.